Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the cricket podcast where I answer your cricket questions. It'd be weird if it wasn't a cricket podcast and I answered your cricket questions, I suppose. But you get the drift. You get where I'm going with this. If you are desperate to answer questions, you can do that in the comments, I suppose. If you're desperate to ask questions, the best way is to support us on Patreon, like so many people do. And thank you to all of those out there who do. They get to ask a question early. But if you are in the YouTube today and you want to ask a super chat, please feel free. And if there's anything else I see that I feel the need to answer or can answer, I'll get in touch with those as well. But let us start with the questions from Patreon. Links in the show notes if you want to support us on Patreon, like Scott has. And Scott says, create your perfect all-round fielder, as in for different aspects of fielding, pick a player for that aspect. Okay, so we'd have Alan Border's throwing, certainly short form throwing. Who would be my long form thrower? Was it Tom Moody that had the record for the longest throw in the world, I think, at one stage? So Tom Moody might be up there for my long throw, but Alan Border for my short throw because he can throw right arm and left arm and got a lot of runouts because of that. Maybe not the most accurate thrower, but fairly accurate, like accurate enough, I think, is fair to say. So I've got my throwing done. Movement, I probably have Andrew Symonds, the quickest and most powerful mover, I think, of anyone that I've seen. Where else would I have? Slip fielding, probably have like Faf du Plessis catching, although Faf du Plessis probably goes a long way to being maybe one of the most all-round footers anywhere on his own. In gully, you probably want that sort of Cam Green, Joel Garner type height, wouldn't you? So if you wanted something there. I think. And then, slip fielding for spinners, would you want, someone like Rahane maybe? I think that's it. And then short leg. I'm trying to think who the most spectacular short leg fielder was. It's someone recently, isn't there? Is it an England fielder who was really, really good in there? It wasn't James Taylor, was it? I think that covers most of it. I mean, I'd need to think. There's a lot of different facets to fielding. But I think that covers quite a bit of it. Scott. Oh, you've got dives as well. Yeah, so I think dives is probably Jonty or Guptill, isn't it? And outfield catching. I'm trying to think. Maybe someone like Pollard, because you want someone tall to protect the boundaries as well. Ruja says, which innings was less representative of batter's ability? Rayner's test debut 100 or Kieran Nair's 300? Aren't they both fairly representative of their talent? Like, so I saw both of them, I think. Rayner was 100 in Sri Lanka. I think I was in Sri Lanka when he made that 100, by the way, weirdly, but not there for the test match. Was a fantastic player of spin, so we would expect that. Kieran Nair averages 49 in first-class cricket, has other triple hundreds. So I actually think they're both fairly representative of who they are. You're talking about two players who... let me just look at Suresh Raina's record in first-class cricket just before I make this huge statement. But I think I'm right. So he averages 42 in first-class cricket. So I suppose you would say him, but he was a fantastic player of spin. And certainly, that wasn't where his issue came in. But I think there are plenty of teams that Suresh Raina would have had a decent test career in, and Nair definitely would have had a good test career, right? Like, you're going to get players like that in the same way that, there's a lot of talk about Stuart Law as a test player. I think Stuart Law or Jamie Siddons as a test player, in the Australian era, I think they were both fantastic players. I don't think they would have gone on to be star players for other countries, though. I think they would have gone on to be good players for other countries. You can do the same with the West Indies, with Sylvester Clark and Roddy Eswick and the 23 other, Franklin Stevenson and all those guys, right, that don't have top-level test careers. If they'd come in, they might have taken wickets, and maybe for the current South African seamers, right? But it's very rare that there's... that the very top players don't make it at the top. But when there's an abundance, you kind of rotate through those guys a little bit quicker. and I think that's what happened with Australian batters in the 90s, 2000s. It's what happened with West Indies bowlers in the 80s. And it's what happened with South African seamers of this era. And so Indian batters are exactly the same. So, look, I think both those players had immense talent. But, you know, it's hard in India. You almost need to, so many things need to go right. Prithvi Shaw is still one of the best young players in the world, right? Scott says, should umpires be allowed to go straight to third umpire for edges if they're not sure? Will this slow the game down too much? Yeah, I think that's the only reason we're not doing it, Scott. I think it is... there is a feeling that will just slow it down a little bit more. There was the ICL. They had a thing where a third umpire would look at every single ball after it was adjudicated by the umpire. And it didn't quite work. And the bigger issue was for the spinners, because it's almost impossible to do it for spinners. Whereas for seam bowlers, there was something available there. But I haven't talked to anyone who was directly involved with that. But the feeling I got from the broadcasting side was that it didn't quite work the way they hoped it would have. William says, can we do a whip around to get South Africa to play more test matches? It's a crime that their pace attack isn't on display more. Yes, but probably we should be quite thankful that their batting wasn't always on display, having seen some of the batting lineups that they've put out recently. Look, they do have a fantastic bowling lineup. There's no doubt about that. And it's very, very entertaining. But then, you know, they've had some issues in test cricket of recent times as well. And, you know, when you have a good bowling attack, it gives you a chance of winning every game, which a good batting lineup does not, right? But it does mean if you have good bowling with an inconsistent batting lineup, with a poor batting lineup, your results are kind of going to be all over the shop. And if you look at South Africa, that's kind of what we've seen from them. You know, if test cricket was run correctly and in a league and everyone got paid. And I see Steve Waugh came out the other day and said, everyone should get the same basic match fee. So, yeah, I mean, universal income, basic income for cricketers is kind of an obvious thing, considering all professional cricketers play their part in the top level players all the way down to the bottom level players into growing our sport, no matter what country they're from. But hey, William says, what's your favorite technically true but not very useful stat? Oh, you put in the Adil Rashid 10 hundreds one there, haven't you? I suppose, is it Ajit Agarkar and Marcus North both being on the Lord's Honor board, but for not their major skills, is probably one of the more famous ones, silly ones. Is it? I just want to have a look. Is it, who's got the lowest bowling average ever? No, Alistair Cook's bowling average is 7. I think Alistair Cook has the low. Oh, no, because Mark Boucher's got a bowling average of 6. So I wasn't even right. But Alistair Cook and Mark Boucher both have bowling averages of 6 and 7, and both having played over 100 matches. And I just have a look. Desmond Haynes also has a bowling average of 8. And Mossim Jaffa, 31 test matches of bowling average of 9, and Michael Slater has one of 10 as well. So there's some really cool little anomalies in those sorts of things. I think also, although this one probably is a bit more illustrative, but I do like the fact, well, actually, no, I like the fact that only two players played for Australia in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and one is Alan Border and the other one is Peter Sleep. There's something kind of ridiculous about those ones. But yeah, usually it's the bowling ones, when someone has that incredibly low average, they usually stick in your mind a little bit more. Ian says, how big of an issue is the revoking of the NOCs for Mujeeb, Fazal Haq, Faruqi and Naveen Al Haq? Missing a BBL game or two is one thing, but it's going to culminate in them not playing international cricket. Look, generally the NOCs are used as a bit of a threat by boards. It's kind of the only card boards have left to play. You know, we talked about it on Uncovered. I think it's restraint of trade. I think it's unprofessional, and I'll ultimately think it will come back and bite you. Alienating your star players, it seems to be the opposite way that you want to go in with the future of cricket, the way that it will be. But yeah, usually these things do get resumed, ironed out fairly quickly. So it might only be a game or two where that happens, but it just doesn't particularly work. But the other option is that one of these players goes, okay, I won't play with you anymore. I'll become a freelancer and try my luck that way. Or I'll go and play Major League Cricket. and become American? Oh, 8 and 9 is the same question. Muku, in case you know, in case you're listening, 8 and 9 is the same question. So you might have missed one from Ian. I'm not sure. It might be someone else. Neuron says, Marvin Adipadu versus Dimas Kurunaratne versus Dennis Jayasuriya. How much has Sri Lanka suffered by having just 3 decent openers in their entire history? Is Dilshan's 53 innings as an opener averaging 42 enough to say he was good at it? Yeah, I definitely think Dilshan was good at it. I think me and Shane were looking at it the other day. I think it was Dilshan that we came up with. It's probably not enough innings to make a big difference in Sri Lankan cricket, but I think he certainly did it for a good amount of time. I think you'll find, Niran, that, you know, you're talking about 3 good openers. How many has New Zealand had in 50 more years? There are countries that struggle to, you know, produce certain kinds of cricket. You know, England and wrist spin in test matches, right? And England and left arm seam after Bill Vos. South Africa and left arm test seam. West Indies and left arm test seam. I'm trying to think of some that aren't those. How many great left arm finger spinners have Australia produced? The top of my head. How many wrist spinners have New Zealand ever had? Do you know what I mean? So, you know, these things do occur. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me because I would have thought that opening in Sri Lanka is not a particularly hard skill, but no one ever seems to be able to do it there. So maybe I'm wrong and I'm missing something. You know, recent times it's become quite interesting just because now teams are so much more likely to use spinners early on. So it's a very different kind of opening than other places. But yeah, I think it's not quite as bad as probably New Zealand's entire history of opening batters. But, you know, I think we might have done this on a Footmarks podcast. I can't remember, but I've got a feeling me and Bayram talked about this where Sri Lanka and Pakistan seem like they're very good at producing middle order players. And this might have been in limited overs cricket. And India's been very good at top order players. But you have a look at India and, you know, Sunil Gavaskar, you know, Rahul Dravid. I'm missing some others, aren't I? Virat Kohli when he batted at first drop, Pujara, Rohit Sharma, you know, a lot of very good top order players. Whereas you look at Pakistan, you know, Meindad, Inzi, Yunus, but maybe Bubba's a little bit higher, but the vast majority of the best Pakistani players, batters are probably middle order. It's a bit more in the air with Sri Lanka, but you know, Aravinda, Mahela, Arjuna, Samarawira, who else am I missing there? You know, those kinds of players, very much middle order players. So there does seem to be a pattern there. I'm not really 100% sure I get that pattern. But yeah, it's something we're seeing. Like how many great Pakistani opening batters would they have had in what? 60 years, 70 years? Now I'm absolutely obsessed with that. I have to know. Because I remember when I did New Zealand, and I've looked up New Zealand by accident. I think the other team I noticed that really struggled the most with the opening batting position was Pakistan. So let's see what I've got here. So Anwar, who is really, really good in the 90s. So he made almost 4,000. So they don't have a single opening batter from Pakistan who's made 4,000 runs. So straight away, you know. So Anwar, 54 matches, averages 47 in the position. Hanif Muhammad averaged 42 in 39 games. Majid Khan, 42 in 26 games. Shoaib Muhammad averaged 40. Abdullah Shafiq is obviously doing it right at the moment. But they don't have anyone over 4,000 runs. They don't really have, they've got a lot of guys who are mid-30s, even low-30s, who've actually opened quite a bit. So Imran Fahad, Mohsin Khan, Saqib Muhammad, where are we? Tawfiq Umar, Muhammad Hafiz, and Mudassir Nazar. All these different guys, all averaging in the 30s, opening the batting. And those are there outside of Anwar and Hanif Muhammad. They're the only ones who average over 40. Oh, sorry, Amir Sohail is also averaging 35. So these patterns do exist. Why? I don't know specifically because unless it's something to do with them at home versus away, you know, maybe when they were when they were opening at home, it's very, very easy. And the minute they go away, it's very, very hard. I don't know if that's a great answer. Let's have a look. Oh God, I put home and away in like an idiot. I wanted to put away and neutral in for Pakistan. I don't know why I did this for Pakistan and not Sri Lanka, but the point being, of course, that they both have problems with it. So Asaidemwa, Azza Ali both did well. Yeah, it doesn't look like it's as much. There's a couple of guys here who average in the 20s away from home, but it's not as much of a graveyard as perhaps I thought it was going to be. So the truth is, I don't really know why those countries do. It makes a little bit more sense in New Zealand because that's a terrible place to open the batting. 10 and 11 is the same question too, Muku, just so you're aware. Niran says, how do you think Babar compares with the other great Pakistani batsmen? It's funny because Niran asked me about Sri Lanka and I've answered a Pakistani question. Maybe I can make this a Sri Lankan question. Does he have what it takes to be the best in the history by the end of their career? I still feel Inzi and Yunus will be better, but Babar will be better than Yusuf. I haven't seen me and Dad bat. Look, me and Dad was probably one of those guys whose numbers don't look quite as good. Me and Dad was averaging 57 up until the last couple of years of his career, and he's ended up with an average of 52, played on probably 3 or 4 years beyond what he should have. Me and Dad, I still think, is the best Pakistani batter. Don't think Yunus is all that far behind him. And Inzi and Yusuf, I'm just pushing them to the side at the moment just because I haven't done my research on those two players for the top 50 batters where I have on the other two. So they've got those in the top of my head. Babar, my wonder with Babar is whether he's a bit of a spree batter who goes on who has a moment where he makes a lot of runs and then has a moment where he doesn't. So if you have a look, so he averages, 25 over his first 10 or 11 test matches. He then averages 55 for a little while, has one bad year, then another good year, then another bad year. If he's going to be me and Dad and Yunus, those are guys who strung lots and lots of years, good years together. And the other thing is, I think it's fair to say this at the moment, he averages 37 away from home, 40 in the UAE and 71 in Pakistan, right? Now, I think me and Dad averaged over 60 in Pakistan as well. So that's, it's a bit like Australian batters. Pakistan and Australia have great pitches. And, if you're a home batter, you're probably going to make a lot of runs there. But again, he's going to have to make some really good runs against other teams and in other conditions. So I think he's a longer distance back than it probably looks at the moment. Having said that, a lot of his career has come during the wobble ball era. How old is he? So he's 29. So he should just be hitting peak here now. And being a Pakistani, he might, he might be 4 years older than we think he is. And B, he might play till he's 43 anyway. But allows him to probably have, another 5 to 6 years of peak batting, we would hope. And so you would hope, in order for him to catch those other guys, he's going to have to be, 45 plus, 50 plus in most of those years. He can't continue to have these yo-yo years, which we've seen over recent times, I think. If he wants to beat the other players. In fact, wait, I've got my stats for the other guys up here, right in front of me. So Javed Meendad, I've got him as 12 years where he averaged over 40 with the bat, and 9 years where he averaged over 50 with the bat, 61 home average, 46 average in England. I'm trying to see if there's anything negative I have down. Averaged less than 30 against the West Indies, but unlike most players, actually played, he's peaked against the peak West Indies. There's a lot of guys like Steve Waugh and Sunil Gavaskar who have really good records against West Indies, kind of didn't play as much against the peak sides. Although there's overlap there, certainly. So you've got to remember that. So that's him. And then I've got Yunus. Oh, Yunus is right under him, the talent. So I've got Yunus at 12 years where he averaged over 40, and 11 of those where he averaged over 50. Yeah. Again, a bit like, and we see this a lot with the Pakistani batters, huge averages at home. But Yunus averages 58 at home, 49 away, and 55 in the UAE. Averaged 50 in Australia and England, 70 in India, not from as many games, struggled with South Africa a little bit. I think if you did an advanced look at Bubba, I just don't think he's anywhere near that level of those of the two things we've just talked about there at the moment on raw average, or even if you start to look at the splits and everything else. Ian says, nerdy question. So, you know, that if this isn't the show. This is about the red inker and how to bowl faster. That was one with Tim Winkmore. If you haven't seen it or listened to it. It was said that bowlers bowling under 85 mile an hour had better averages than bowlers bowling over 85 in the county championship. Was there a comparison made of averages of bowlers who could sit on both sides of that? No, I don't think so. I would have assumed that that was looking, it wasn't looking at bowlers per se. It would have been looking at deliveries. So in England, the average, you're more likely to average lower with a lower speed than you are with a higher speed. So it wouldn't be one in individual bowlers. So do bowlers like Atkinson and Tong, who can sit on either side of that, take more wickets with pace off? Yes, they do. I'm not saying every bowler would. There would be certain bowlers, I don't think Mark Wood would have a higher average in if he was bowling 82 miles an hour than he would if he was bowling 88 miles an hour. But the vast majority of bowlers who are on either side of that 85 mile an hour line would have more success. So the point being is that if you bowl fast in England, you've got less chance of getting the lateral movement. And because the pitches don't really react really perfectly well to faster balls, you're better to slow down a little bit. So we saw Jofra Archer go to Lords and bowl really, really fast and then come to Headingley and slow it down to 82, 83 miles an hour. If you talk to old county bowlers, that's what they always did, right? And so they knew that that was a thing. Even before the data has just completely confirmed it for everyone, right? Patrick says, how can you account for the impact of strike rate in your tests? Is 100 strike rate much more impactful than a 75 strike rate? Yeah, so the best way of looking at that is when you are scoring at a run a ball, at a strike rate of 100, you are putting so much pressure on the opposition in a test match, right? So you have the ability at that stage to score 100, 200 runs in a session. That's never going to happen because no one's ever going to bowl their full amount of overs. But, you know, you have the ability in one session to completely change the complexion of a game if you're scoring at a run a ball. If you're scoring at 75 strike rate, you're talking about what? So I think most strike rates sort of hover on either side around 50. I think it's a little bit lower than that. It's like 47, 48, but around that point. So if you're scoring at a strike rate of 60, you're probably not putting consistent pressure on the opposition. If you're scoring at a strike rate of 75, you're talking about scoring 33% quicker than the average player, right? Or 50% quicker, depending on how you look at it, right? But quite a decent amount quicker than what the other player is scoring at. That you can feel. So the difference between 50 and 75 is really, really noticeable. The difference between 50 and 60, you know that person probably can get away from you, but will also not always do that. So that's why I don't factor in 60, I'm talking modern cricket, as a huge strike rate. When I start to get excited when you're around 75, 80, because that is a strike rate that does jumble up bowlers' minds, captains' minds, and analysts' minds, I suppose, as well, coaches' minds, because things are happening so quickly and you do start to panic. So that brings in other impacts, right? You might have to yank someone out of the attack. Your plans that you had for the rest of the day, your bowling plans have completely now gone. You have to think of new fields on the fly that you weren't particularly looking at. And let's say you start the day, you've made 350, and the other team is, I don't know, 200 for four, right? And it's the start of day three. And you're like, well, if we chip away here, and then that person who strikes at 75, 80, or 100, as you've said, Patrick, has the ability within a session to take that lead away, right? That's very different than a standard batter who's going to chip away from it. It's going to take them a couple of sessions, and you think as long as you hold in, and you can nip away the odd one, you can get that. Whereas that other guy can completely change everything very, very quickly. So it is a big, big impact. I've said before, there is another argument to be made in Test cricket that you should bat slower. And you should bat slower so your bowlers are always fresher. And it's not really talked about much. But we rest bowlers. We don't enforce the follow-on for the same reason. But we have teams who try and score really, really quickly. So they've scored 400, but they've done it in 80 overs. That means my bowlers have one day off. So there, I think there is also an argument for that at times. But certainly, you know, the impact of Viv Richards or Adam Gilchrist, Sehwag, you know, Trumper, certainly, to just mess with teams, right? Just get them confused. You know, having been at some of those great KP innings, we're just like, oh my God, like, you know, what's going to happen here? And Bazball, like Bazball legitimately messed with the minds of some of those, like Australia and now looking down on Bazball. They looked pretty confused by Bazball when it was working as well, right? And, you know, they eventually maybe outclassed it a little bit and, you know, got some luck with the results falling at the way that they did early on. But they got messed up by Bazball as well. And, you know, we've certainly seen, you know, New Zealand and India, which, you know, with experienced players out on the field, just get a little bit flustered. That's what faster strike rates do, because it just moves the game on quicker. So you have to make your decisions just that little bit faster. Vickers says, do you think Virat spoiled young cricket? Do you think Virat spoiled young cricketers, especially Indians who want to play all format like him? Because it's very hard to get good in all three formats for a long time. Every big player used to play ODI and Test in the past, and they were good in both. Well, not all of them were. But could players do the same with T20 and Test, or is it hard? No, it isn't. Virat has nothing to do with it. What has changed is that, so I remember, I think it was Harry Gurney talked about this. Harry Gurney, you know, played first-class cricket, and I think I had him on the podcast. I think he might have even said it was his favourite format. And he sort of went, well, I can be a little bit good at this and a little bit good at this and a little bit good at this, or I can specialise on the thing that's going to make me the most money. And so he specialises on that. So if you're Virat Kohli or Jaiswal or Baba Azam, right, or Travis Head, if you're one of those players, you could spend a little bit of time getting used to this and a little bit of time used to this and a little bit of time. Your overall talent might still help you be successful in all three, but chances are you're not going to be the world's best in all three, because someone else somewhere is just going to be like, well, I'm going to spend all my time on that one, right? So how could you ever compare to someone like that? You would have to be an absolute freak. So yeah, we will still have players who are, you know, world beaters in both different formats. I'm trying to think if there's anyone sort of younger coming through. I don't think there's anyone obvious, but we will still get those players that will come through while we have three formats and while, you know, there's still a reason for players to play all three. But what you're talking about is when every player used to play ODI and Test, which isn't quite true anyway, if you go back, but was certainly more true. There were no specialists, right? We were just really before Michael Bevan, even Michael Bevan was a Test player. You didn't have many specialists in one-day cricket. You had a few guys who weren't good enough to play Test cricket, but had some skills for white ball cricket. But even they were still playing a lot of first-class cricket in the rest of that. Jeez, sorry. My neighbor's trampoline just went flying through their backyard. Oh, and so is my basketball ring. It's windy here, everyone. But yeah, it's very hard to go up against people who are specialists in things when you're not a specialist, even if you're better. Vicar says, I'm hearing a lot about Indian players who aren't doing practice sessions during or pre-series from Indian journalists. They often have optional practice sessions where a lot of players don't show up, even young players. Even before the World Cup final, all Australian players were doing practice for a few hours and Indian players showed up quite late. How much practice matters before any game or a tour like South Africa? Yeah, I don't know about those reports. most batters like to bat a lot anyway, but maybe they're not doing it in proper net sessions. Maybe they're doing it in other places. So I'd always be skeptical of that. I mean, but Ricky Ponting wasn't a big net player. He didn't really like to be in the nets all that much. We've had a real generation of recently of batters who really love batting in the nets. You know, guys like Puran. I think Bubba might be another one. Obviously, Steve Smith, Marnus. There's a few others I can't think of as well, who just like absolute net heads, right? Who, you know, want to be in the nets for 4 or 5 hours. If it's optional training, there's probably a reason that, as someone who's worked with cricket teams, generally when you do optional training, there is a reason. And it's probably because the travel schedule has got a bit much, or you're starting to see fatigue in your players, or just players need a break. So if it is optional, that's okay not to do it. It's funny that you talk about the World Cup final. It could have been just the schedules and the way that the two teams arrived at that time, where one team felt fresh and one team didn't feel fresh. So I would never be too worried about that sort of stuff. From what I've seen, there's plenty of Indian players who are net heads. It's a bit different with the bowlers. Bowlers are really stopped from that a lot now, and the way that they do that. I mean, and practice matters, but realistically, India didn't lose the World Cup final or didn't lose his last test match because they didn't practice enough. If anyone's trying to make that point, they're wrong. James says, the rationale for retaining umpire's call in DRS LBWs apparently is that there are margins of error in identifying the point of impact with the bat. It's definitely a big part of that, James. And in algorithmically predicting the ball's trajectory. However, do we have any research to indicate that these margins for error are actually less for human umpires than for DRS? If not, why do we fall back on the umpires? I don't know if they've got research on that directly, James, but I think the point is that the Hawkeye people, and I suppose the other companies who have been involved, are saying and said to the ICC, we don't feel as comfortable with these sort of decisions at times. And so we would like a safety net. And the only real safety net that we have at the moment is the umpire's decision, right? There isn't a third safety net that we have. We don't have another form of technology. Perhaps if we had two different competing forms of technology or there was another way of doing it, that would be fine. But, you know, I go with the people who design the technology who are saying to the ICC, we would like this thing, rather than a former player who goes, I don't know why we have umpires call. Bloody says, listen to Crick Picks commentators episode. Due to the age of your co-host and me, I'm quite young too, you didn't discuss the old TMS guys. Well, I think if you listen, we didn't really talk about the radio commentators all that much. I think this is very much this last 30 years, maybe since the 90s, has really been a TV generation, right? So especially since cable TV existed and now streaming platforms. So we didn't talk about the old TMS guys. Also, none of us are English, remember? None of us grew up listening to TMS, which is the other thing. Where are we? How would you rate them? So you're talking about Blofeld, Johnson, CMJ. Look, I've got issues with Blofeld. I've met him. He was lovely to me when I met him once or twice, but I've got issues with him. He was a person who got famous for leaving a county game because he had tickets to the opera or whatever it was, or to a theatre show, rather than actually reply to finish his report and something happened in the game. If that happens to a normal cricket writer, that's the end of their career. And with him, it was seen to be fine. You know, I think Jonathan Liu wrote a great article about the privilege of Blofeld. Blofeld didn't really call the cricket, right? And I think he'd be quite honest in that. I think he would say, I called the colour and I called the moment and everything else. I didn't particularly enjoy it. I don't particularly enjoy TMS as a product, because I think that is what they try and do. It is a cultural product rather than a cricket product. Johnson, I don't remember Johnson very much. I know I would have listened to him, but he never stood out. CMJ, I thought, was excellent, because CMJ was a proper cricket head, right? He was the person on there talking about things in cricket. And I think we mentioned him in the Crick Picks episode. If I didn't, I should have. I thought he was my favorite of that lot, and he wasn't that far away from my list as well. When I came over and I started listening to TMS, having listened to ABC minis, I was really disappointed in TMS. I remember like one of the first times I listened to them, there was like a 10-minute conversation on cufflinks. And I was just like, this is just not for me, right? And it's not. They would be, if you talk to them personally, they would be very honest in saying that it's not really for people like me. It is for a certain class of people in England. And it's a cultural product, and that's fine. But yeah, because of that, I probably would rate them. That doesn't mean I don't think Jonathan Agnew is not a brilliant broadcaster. Obviously, Daniel Norcross is there now. Simon Mann, love Ebbs as well. I think Alison was on our list, so she's a TMS commentator. But I think as an overall product, you know, there's something about the them saying unfunny jokes and the producer laughing in the background, and then cake, that just doesn't work for me as a cricket fan. And that's fine. As I said, I'm not their target audience, and they're more than aware of that, as I am. There was a very interesting thing, though. I don't know if you saw this, Bloody, about the diversity thing that you mentioned as here as well. When Jeffrey Boycott wrote an article for The Telegraph suggesting that the BBC didn't get the rights to the India series because of diversity. They didn't get the rights to the India series because they didn't pay enough money. I mean, Boycott would know that because he understands the business as well as I do. He's a real expert in rights issues, in fact. He's been involved in a lot of them before. But it was a hilarious article. I hope no one else from TMS was involved in writing that article, because it would be an absolute embarrassment for those people if that got out, that they were involved with writing that article. Because the truth is that TalkSport just outbid them. So I'll be going to India and they won't be, which is fine. I miss out on tours sometimes, and you know, they've got all the home series. That's the business. But I would say that BBC is probably more interesting, or TMS is more interesting with more diversity and voices as it's gone ahead. And be interesting to see what the future of that is, and how they see it as well. And James says the cricketing world seems to be reluctant to let go of perceived Australian indiscretions in a timely fashion in comparison to similar indiscretions from other countries. Would you agree? And if so, why is this the case? Is it because they're the most successful team and they bully people and then they tell people where the line is, James? Is it that? Is it also the hypocrisy that they play cricket the right way and everyone else plays cricket the wrong way? Is it possibly that? Is it because they sledge people and ask them how different players' dicks taste in their mouths, but when the other player gets really upset and says something about their girlfriend or wife, they go, whoa, you've stepped the line. Is it possibly those sorts of things, James? No, and you talk about the uncouth, uncultural, antisocial. No, it's not that. It is literally that they have bullied and told everyone how to do everything for years, and everyone's kind of sick of it. The people don't like bullies. And James, I think you'll have to agree, Australian cricket have been bullies on and off the field at times. I think we've already done that one. Ellie says, wouldn't quarterfinals and semifinals added to the World Test Championship make more teams interested in Test cricket? I think the World Test Championships already worked, Ellie. Yes, it would work, whether the times work. We're just running out of days, man. But I get offered World Test Championships suggestions all the time. No doubt, there's a million things you can do with it. It's not by accident that it is the way it is. Oh, that's James again for some reason. And Swami Nathan says, please don't perceive me as this trying to tell you how to do your job. Will you pay me on Patreon, Swami, so you can. Can Bearam and Estelle sit in for you on Wagon Wheel when you're unavailable? Yeah, they probably will. We haven't quite got to that level yet. I'd love to see the kids grow up. They're both quite old. You know, they might look young compared to me. Would you please start the cricket version of The Athletic? Look, I'm probably on the third different time of trying to start the cricket version of The Athletic. Maybe the fourth. I might be on the fourth incarnation of trying to make it work. 99.94 was the most public one, of course. Yeah, I would love to do it. And it's not about the written word either, because there would be plenty of podcasts and videos and other things available there as well. But I don't think cricket is covered correctly. I don't think it's done the way that it should be. And I personally believe that I understand the way that people consume online cricket as well as anyone, and would love to have the opportunity to be able to turn everything I've learned into something else. It's about investment. You're talking about to do the cricket, the Athletic, you're looking at $1.5 to $2 million a year in investment. And I haven't been able to get that yet. I've been very close a couple of times, but I haven't got the check. And until I get the check, we're in the same situation. I'll keep growing my stuff and working for other organizations and, you know, more than happy to consult with other people. But the truth is that someone's eventually going to do either a podcast network or The Athletic or a combination of both. And they will do very well with it if they run it in the right way. But it needs funding. And I just haven't been able to get that kind of funding so far. I am going to have to head off because I think I have to do... Oh, that's not going to work, is it? Because I left to take that down. But I'll do a couple of super chats because Samit says, how does the role of the analyst change across formats? T20 higher variance format where data-driven matchup may lead to a higher marginal gain, mitigate talent disparity compared to test. I've never been an analyst in a test match, but But I still think that there are little moments where you want your team, you know, in T20 cricket, kind of every ball matters. And so, you know, you're sort of hyperactive. But in test cricket, it's just a slower game, so you have more time. But one decision in test cricket can have maybe a bigger impact over the, you know, 2 days of cricket, right? So I don't know. That's probably one for someone like Nathan Lehman, maybe Freddie Wild now. I'm trying to think of other people. Prasanna is another one who's probably done across formats. But for me, I've never actually been an analyst for a first-class team. I've helped first-class teams and I've helped test teams on occasion, but I've never sat there and done the job. So I don't know, but I would think it would just be, it's just a tempo thing that would be different. You know, you still have, I would think there would be more theorizing as a test analyst and probably more practical, tell the person to do this thing in the next over thing in T20. But I am only guessing. No one knows. Thank you for your super chat. I was doing my own version of true economy rates and true wickets. And I realized that Dinda has a true economy rate of zero, but he was trolled a lot. Can you think of another such example? Jade Dernbach is why I came up with true economy rate. No one knows. And for those who don't know, what we're really saying is we are looking at their economy rate for the overs they bowl. So contextually, so if you bowl the last over and you go for 9.5 runs an over and everyone else goes for 10, then you are a plus bowler at the end, right? And quite significantly in that case. So Jade Dernbach was the one I came up with it as a death bowler because people kept saying he's the most expensive bowler ever. And I was like, yeah, of course he is. He bowls a high percentage of death overs than anyone else. That's exactly what I found out. And Jade's quite happy with me for having explained this over and over again for him. So he's the obvious one there. The other one was, I think, Mitch McClenaghan. I think when I looked at the raw numbers of his striking in power play, it looked good, but not great. But I think I'm right in saying when I went back in some of those years, you really got it. Like when you did, you know, true wickets or true average or, you know, any of those kind of metrics, you were like, oh, okay, this makes a lot more sense now. And you know, it's a good way of thinking of it. But they're great metrics. Hopefully we'll eventually, a bit like the athletic thing, hopefully eventually I have my own basketball reference type page up and everything else. But that's going to be it for me today because I have to do some errands. A little bit shorter than usual, though, you know, still 43 minutes and 32 seconds. 35 seconds. Thank you very much, everyone, for being in the chat today. I'll just have a look who was in there. I know I didn't get to all your questions, but Sitesh is in there. Dex, Max, Udit, Register, Shah, SH Rules. Yes, he does. And Srinath was in there as well. So thank you to everyone. Comment, like, subscribe, do all those things. And I will be back very soon to do more shows and more things. And I'm always around. This is the Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber. I said that like I wasn't sure. It makes me sound like I don't know my own name. And I don't know. Maybe that's true. Maybe I have forgot my own name. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. Do you make content but don't want to listen to yourself talk? Well, I get that. Memento FM's AI does all the listening for you. It picks out the highlights and it makes you sound far more amazing than you really are. Embrace Memento FM today.